afraid he might ignore her or worse, turn hateful again, and send her weeping from the table. Instead, Joffrey smiled and kissed her hand, handsome and gallant as any prince in the songs, and said, "Sir Loras has a keen eye for beauty, sweet lady." He was too kind, she demurred, trying to remain modest and calm, though her heart was singing. "Sir Loras is a true knight. Do you think he will win tomorrow, my lord?" "No," Geoffrey said. "My dog will do for him, or perhaps my uncle Jamie. And in a few years, when I'm old enough to enter the lists, I shall do for them all." He raised his hand to summon a servant with a flagon of iced summer wine and poured her a cup. She looked anxiously at Septa Mordaine, until Joffrey leaned over and filled the Septa's cup as well. So she nodded and thanked him graciously and said not another word. The servants kept their cups filled all night, yet afterwards Sansa could not recall ever tasting the wine. She needed no wine. She was drunk on the magic of that night, giddy with glamour, swept away by beauties she had dreamt of all her life and never dared hope to know. Singers sat before the king's pavilion, filling the dusk with music. A juggler kept a cascade of burning clubs spinning through the air. The king's own fool, the pie-faced simpleton called Moonboy, danced about on stilts, all in motley, making mock of everyone with such deft cruelty that Sansa wondered if he was simple after all. Even Septa Mordaine was helpless before him. When he sang his little song about the High Septon, she laughed so loud she spilled wine on herself. And Joffrey was the soul of courtesy. He talked to Sansa all night, showering her with compliments, making her laugh, sharing little bits of court gossip, explaining Moonboy's japes. Sansa was so captivated that she quite forgot all her courtesies and ignored Septa Mordaine seated to her left. All the while the courses came and went, a thick soup of barley and venison, salads of sweet grass and spinach and plums sprinkled with crushed nuts, snails in honey and garlic. Sansa had never eaten snails before. Joffrey showed her how to get the snail out of the shell and fed her the first sweet morsel himself. Then came trout, fresh from the river, baked in clay. Her prince helped her crack open the hard casing to expose the flaky, white flesh within. And when the meat course was brought out, he served to himself, slicing a queen's portion from the joint, smiling as he laid it on her plate. She could see from the way he moved that his right arm was still troubling him, yet he uttered not a word of complaint. Later came sweetbreads and pigeon pie and baked apples fragrant with cinnamon and lemon cakes frosted in sugar. But by then Sansa was so stuffed that she could not manage more than two little lemon cakes, as much as she loved them. She was wondering whether she might attempt a third when the king began to shout. King Robert had grown louder with each course. From time to time Sansa could hear him laughing or roaring a command over the music and the clangor of plates and cutlery, but they were too far away for her to make out his words. Now everyone heard him. "No!" he thundered, in a voice that drowned out all other speech. Sansa was shocked to see the king on his feet, red of face, reeling. He had a goblet of wine in one hand, and he was drunk as a man could be. "You do not tell me what to do, woman!" he screamed at Queen Cersei. "I am king here. Do you understand? I rule here, and if I say that I will fight tomorrow, I will fight." Everyone was staring. Sansa saw Sir Barristan and the king's brother Renly, and the short man who had talked to her so oddly and touched her hair, but no one made a move to interfere. The queen's face was a mask, so bloodless that it might have been sculpted from snow. She rose from the table, gathered her skirts around her, and stormed off in silence, servants trailing behind. Jaime Lannister put a hand on the king's shoulder, but the king shoved him away hard. Lannister stumbled and fell. The king guffawed. "The great knight! I can still knock you in the dirt. Remember that, Kingslayer?" He slapped his chest with his jeweled goblet, splashing wine all over his satin tunic. "Give me my hammer, and not a man in the realm can stand before me." Jaime Lannister rose and brushed himself off. "As you say, Your Grace." His voice was stiff. Lord Renly came forward, smiling. "You've spilled your wine, Robert. Let me fetch you a fresh goblet." Sansa started as Joffrey laid a hand on her arm. "It grows late," the prince said. He had a queer look in his face, as if he were not seeing her at all. "Do you need an escort back to the castle?" "No," Sansa began. She looked for Septa Mordaine and was startled to find her, with her head on the table, snoring soft and ladylike snores. "I mean to say, yes, thank you, that would be most kind. I am tired, and the way is so dark. I should be glad for some protection." Joffrey called out, "Dog!" Sandor Clegane seemed to take form out of the night, so quickly did he appear. He had exchanged his armour for a red woollen tunic with a leather dog's head sewn on the front. The light of the torches made his burned face shine a dull red. "Yes, Your Grace," he said. "Take my betrothed back to the castle and see that no harm befalls her," the prince told him brusquely, and without even a word of farewell, Joffrey strode off, leaving her there. Sansa could feel the hound watching her. "Did you think Joff was going to take you himself?" he laughed. He had a laugh like the snarling of dogs in a pit. "Small chance of that." He pulled her unresisting to her feet. "Come, you're not the only one who needs sleep. I've drunk too much, and I may need to kill my brother tomorrow." He laughed again. Suddenly terrified, Sansa pushed at Septa Mordaine's shoulder, hoping to wake her, but she only snored the louder. King Robert had stumbled off and half the benches were suddenly empty. The feast was over, and the beautiful dream had ended with it. The hound snatched up a torch to light their way. Sansa followed close beside him. The ground was rocky and uneven. The flickering light made it seem to shift and move beneath her. She kept her eyes lowered, watching where she placed her feet. They walked among the pavilions, each with its banner and its armour hung outside, the silence weighing heavier with every step. Sansa could not bear the sight of him. He frightened her so. Yet she had been raised in all the ways of courtesy. A true lady would not notice his face, she told herself. "You rode gallantly today, Sir Sandor," she made herself say. Sandor Clegane snarled at her. "Spare me your empty little compliments, girl. And your sirs. I'm no knight. I spit on them, and their vows. My brother is a knight. Did you see him ride today?" "Yes," Sansa whispered, trembling. "He was gallant," the hound finished. He was mocking her, she realized. No one could withstand him, she managed at last, proud of herself. It was no lie. Sandor Clegane stopped suddenly in the middle of a dark and empty field. She had no choice but to stop beside him. "Some Septa trained you well. You're like one of those birds from the Summer Isles, aren't you? Pretty little talking bird, repeating all the pretty little words they taught you to recite." "That's unkind." Sansa could feel her heart fluttering in her chest. "You're frightening me. I want to go now." "No one could withstand him," the hound rasped. "That's truth enough. No one could ever withstand Gregor. That boy today, his second joust, oh, that was a pretty bit of business. You saw that, did you? Fool boy, he had no business riding in this company. No money, no squire, no one to help him with his armour. That gorget wasn't fastened proper. You think Gregor didn't notice that? You think Sir Gregor's lance rode up by chance, do you? Pretty little talking girl, you believe that. You're empty-headed as a bird for true. Gregor's lance goes where Gregor wants it to go. Look at me, look at me." Sandor Clegane put a huge hand under her chin and forced her face up. He squatted in front of her and moved the torch close. "There's pretty for you. Take a good long stare. You know you want to. I've watched you turning away all the way down the King's Road. Piss on that. Take your look. His fingers held her jaw as hard as an iron trap. His eyes watched hers, drunken eyes, sullen with anger. She had to look. The right side of his face was gaunt, with sharp cheekbones and a grey eye beneath a heavy brow. His nose was large and hooked, his hair thin, dark. He wore it long and brushed it sideways because no hair grew on the other side of that face. The left side of his face was a ruin. His ear had been burned away. There was nothing left but a hole. His eye was still good, but all around it was a twisted mass of scar, slick black flesh, hard as leather, pocked with craters and fissured by deep cracks that gleamed red and wet when he moved. Down by his jaw, you could see the hint of bone where the flesh had been seared away. Sansa began to cry. He let go of her then and snuffed out the torch in the dirt. No pretty words for that, girl. No little compliment the scepter taught you. When there was no answer, he continued. Most of them. They think it was some battle. A siege, a burning tower, an enemy with a torch. One fool asked me if it was dragon's breath. His laugh was softer this time, but just as bitter. I'll tell you what it was, girl, he said, in a voice from the night, a shadow leaning so close now that she could smell the sour stench of wine on his breath. I was younger than you, 6, maybe 7. A woodcarver set up shop in the village under my father's keep, and to buy a favour, he sent us gifts. The old man made marvellous toys. I don't remember what I got, but it was Gregor's gift I wanted. A wooden knight all painted up, every joint pegged separate, and fixed with strings, so you could make him fight. Gregor is 5 years older than me. The toy was nothing to him. He was already a squire, 6 feet tall and muscled like an ox. So I took his knight. But there was no joy in it, I tell you. I was scared all the while, and true enough, he found me. There was a brazier in the room. Gregor never said a word, just picked me up under his arm and shoved the side of my face down on the burning coals and held me there while I screamed and screamed. You saw how strong he is. Even then, it took 3 grown men to drag him off me. The Septons preach about the 7 hells. What do they know? Only a man who's been burned knows what hell is truly like. My father told everyone my bedding had caught fire, and our maester gave me ointments. Ointments? Gregor got his ointments too. 4 years later, they anointed him with the 7 oils, and he recited his nightly vows, and Rhaegar Targaryen tapped him on his shoulder and said, "Arise, Sir Gregor." The rasping voice trailed off. He squatted silently before her, a hulking black shape, shrouded in night, hidden from her eyes. Sansa could hear his ragged breathing. She was sad for him, she realized. Somehow the fear had gone away. The silence went on and on, so long that she began to grow afraid once more. But she was afraid for him now, not for herself. She found his massive shoulder with her hand. He was no true knight, she whispered to him. The hound threw back his head and roared. Sansa stumbled back away from him, but he caught her arm.
No, he growled at her. No, little bird, he was no true knight.
The rest of the way into the city, Sandor Clegane said not a word. He led her to where the carts were waiting, told a driver to take them back to the Red Keep, and climbed in after her. They rode in silence through the King's Gate and up torchlit city streets. He opened the postern door and led her into the castle, his burned face twitching and his eyes brooding, and he was one step behind her as they climbed the tower stairs. He took her safe all the way to the corridor outside her bedchamber.
"Thank you, my lord," Sansa said meekly.
The Hound caught her by the arm and leaned close. "The things I told you tonight," he said, his voice sounding even rougher than usual. "If you ever tell Joffrey, your sister, your father, any of them..."
"I won't," Sansa whispered. I promise."
It was not enough. "If you ever tell anyone," he finished, "I'll kill you."
The Reaver. The drums were pounding out a battle beat as the Iron Victory swept forward, her ram cutting through the choppy green waters. The smaller ship ahead was turning, oars slapping at the sea. Roses streamed upon her banners, fore and aft a white rose upon a red escutcheon, atop her mast a golden one on a field as green as grass. The Iron Victory raked her side so hard that half the boarding party lost their feet. Oars snapped and splintered, sweet music to the captain's ears. He vaulted over the gunwale, landing on the deck below with his golden cloak billowing behind him. The white roses drew back, as men always did at the sight of Victorian Greyjoy, armed and armoured, his face hidden behind his kraken helm. They were clutching swords and spears and axes, but 9 of every 10 wore no armour, and the 10th had only a shirt of sewn scales. "These are no iron men," Victorian thought. "They still fear drowning." "Get him!" one man shouted. "He's alone!" "Come!" he roared back. "Come kill me if you can." From all sides the rosy warriors converged, with grey steel in their hands and terror behind their eyes. Their fear was so ripe, Victorian could taste it. Left and right he laid about, hewing off the first man's arm at the elbow, cleaving through the shoulder of the second. The third buried his own axe head in the soft pine of Victorian's shield. He slammed it into the fool's face, knocked him off his feet, and slew him when he tried to rise again. As he was struggling to free his axe from the dead man's ribcage, a spear jabbed him between the shoulder blades. It felt as though someone had slapped him in the back. Victorian spun and slammed his axe down onto the spearman's head, feeling the impact in his arm as the steel went crunching through helm and hair and skull. The man swayed for half a heartbeat till the iron captain wrenched the steel free and sent his corpse staggering loose-limbed across the deck, looking more drunk than dead. By then his iron born had followed him down onto the deck of the broken longship. He heard Wolf One Ear let out a howl as he went to work, glimpsed Ragnar Pike in his rusted mail, saw Newt the barber send a throwing axe spinning through the air to catch a man in the chest. Victorian slew another man and another. He would have killed a third, but Ragnar cut him down first. "Well struck!" Victorian bellowed at him. When he turned to find the next victim for his axe, he spied the other captain across the deck. His white surcoat was spotted with blood and gore, but Victorian could make out the arms upon his breast, the white rose within its red escutcheon. The man bore the same device upon his shield, on a white field with a red embattled border. "You," the iron captain called across the carnage, "you of the rose, be you the lord of Southshield?" The other raised his visor to show a beardless face. "His son and heir, Sir Talbot Surrey. And who are you, Kraken?" "Your death," Victorian bulled toward him. Surrey leapt to meet him. His longsword was good castle-forged steel, and the young knight made it sing. His first cut was low, and Victorian deflected it off his axe. His second caught the iron captain on the helm before he got his shield up. Victorian answered with a sidearm blow of his axe. Surrey's shield got in the way. Wooden splinters flew, and the white rose split lengthwise with a sweet, sharp crack. The young knight's longsword hammered at his thigh, once, twice, thrice, screaming against the steel. "This boy is quick," the iron captain realized. He smashed his shield in Seri's face and sent him staggering back against the gunwale. Victorian raised his axe and put all his weight behind his cut to open the boy from neck to groin, but Seri spun away. The axe head crashed through the rail, sending splinters flying, and lodged there when he tried to pull it free. The deck moved under his feet, and he stumbled to one knee. Sir Talbot cast away his broken shield and slashed down with his longsword. Victorian's own shield had twisted half around when he stumbled. He caught Ceri's blade in an iron fist. Lobstered steel crunched, and a stab of pain made him grunt, yet Victorian held on. "I am quick as well, boy," he said, as he ripped the sword from the knight's hand and flung it into the sea. Sir Talbot's eyes went wide. "My sword!" Victorian caught the lad about the throat with a bloody fist. "Go and get it," he said, forcing him backwards over the side into the blood-stained waters. That won him a respite to pull his axe loose. The white roses were falling back before the iron tide. Some tried to flee below decks, as others cried for quarter. Victorian could feel warm blood trickling down his fingers beneath the mail and leather and lobstered plate, but that was nothing. Around the mast, a thick knot of foemen fought on, standing shoulder to shoulder in a ring. These few are men, at least. They would sooner die than yield. Victorian would grant some of them that wish. He beat his axe against his shield and charged them. The drowned god had not shaped Victorian Greyjoy to fight with words at Kingsmoots, nor struggle against furtive sneaking foes in endless bogs. This was why he had been put on earth, to stand steel-clad with an axe red and dripping in his hand, dealing death with every blow. They hacked at him from front and back, but their swords might have been willow switches for all the harm they did him. No blade could cut through Victorian Greyjoy's heavy plate, nor did he give his foes the time to find the weak points at the joints, where only mail and leather warded him. Let three men assail him, or four or five, it made no matter. He slew them one at a time, trusting in his steel to protect him from the others. As each foe fell, he turned his wrath upon the next. The last man to face him must have been a smith. He had shoulders like a bull, and one much more muscular than the other. His armor was a studded brigandine and a cap of boiled leather. The only blow he landed completed the ruin of Victorian's shield, but the cut the captain dealt in answer split his head in two. Would that I could deal with the crow's eye as simply. When he jerked his axe head free again, the smith's skull seemed to burst. Bone and blood and brain went everywhere, and the corpse fell forward up against his legs. Too late to plead for quarter now, Victorian thought, as he untangled himself from the dead man. By then the deck was slick beneath his feet, and the dead and the dying lay in heaps on every side. He threw his shield away and sucked in air. "Lord Captain," he heard the barber say beside him, "the day is ours." All around, the sea was full of ships. Some were burning, some were sinking, some had been smashed to splinters. Between the hulls, the water was thick as stew, full of corpses, broken oars, and men clinging to the wreckage. In the distance, half a dozen of Southron longships were racing back toward the Mander. Let them go, Victorian thought. Let them tell the tale. Once a man had turned his tail and run from battle, he ceased to be a man. His eyes were stinging from the sweat that had run down into them during the fight. Two of his oarsmen helped undo his kraken helm so he might lift it off. Victorian mopped at his brow. "That knight," he grumbled, "the knight of the white rose. Did any of you pull him out?" A lord's son would be worth a goodly ransom, from his father if Lord Ceri had survived the day, from his liege at Highgarden if not. None of his men had seen what became of the knight after he went over the side, however. Most like, the man had drowned. May he feast as he fought in the drowned god's watery halls. Though the men of the Shield Islands called themselves sailors, they crossed the sea in dread and went lightly clad in battle for fear of drowning. Young Ceri had been different. A brave man, thought Victorian, almost ironborn. He gave the captured ship to Ragnar Pike, named a dozen men to crew her, and clambered back up onto his own iron Victory. "Strip the captives of arms and armor and have their wounds bound up," he told Newt the barber. "Throw the dying in the sea. If any beg for mercy, cut their throats first." He had only contempt for such. Better to drown on seawater than on blood. I want a count of the ships we won, and all the knights and lordlings we took captive. I want their banners, too. One day he would hang them in his hall, so when he grew old and feeble he could remember all the foes he had slain when he was young and strong. It will be done, Newt grinned. It is a great victory. Aye, he thought, a great victory for the crows, aye, and his wizards. The other captains would shout his brother's name and knew when the tidings reached Oakenshield. Euron had seduced them with his glib tongue and smiling eye and bound them to his cause with the plunder of half a hundred distant lands. Gold and silver ornate armor, curved swords with gilded pommels, daggers of Valyrian steel, striped tiger pelts and the skins of spotted cats, jade manticores and ancient Valyrian sphinxes, chests of nutmeg, cloves and saffron, ivory tusks and the horns of unicorns, green and orange and yellow feathers from the summer sea, bolts of fine silk and shimmering samite. And yet all that was little and less compared to this. Now he has given them conquest, and they are his for good and all, the captain thought. The taste was bitter on his tongue. This was my victory, not his. Where was he? Back on Oakenshield, lazing in a castle? He stole my wife and he stole my throne, and now he steals my glory. Obedience came naturally to Victorian Greyjoy. He had been born to it. Growing to manhood in the shadow of his brothers, he had followed Balon dutifully in everything he did. Later, when Balon's sons were born, he had grown to accept that one day he would kneel to them as well, when one of them took his father's place upon the sea stone chair. But the drowned god had summoned Balon and his sons down to his watery halls, and Victorian could not call Euron king without tasting bile in his throat. The wind was freshening, and his thirst was raging. After a battle, he always wanted wine. He gave the deck to Newt and went below. In his cramped cabin aft, he found the dusky woman, wet and ready. Perhaps the battle had warmed her blood as well. He took her twice in quick succession. When they were done, there was blood smeared across her breasts and thighs and belly, but it was his blood from the gash in his palm. The dusky woman washed it out for him with boiled vinegar. The plan was good, I grant him, Victorian said as she knelt beside him. The Mander is open to us now, as it was of old. It was a lazy river, wide and slow and treacherous with snags and sandbars. Most sea-going vessels dared not sail beyond Highgarden, but longships with their shallow drafts could navigate as far upstream as Bitterbridge. In ancient days, the Ironborn had boldly sailed the River Road and plundered all along the Mander and its vassal streams, until the kings of the Green Hand had armed the fisherfolk on the four small islands off the Mander's mouth and named them his shields. 2,000 years had passed, but in the watch towers along their craggy shores, Greybeards still kept the ancient vigil. At the first glimpse of longships, the old men would light their beacon fires, and the call would leap from hill to hill and island to island. Fear, foes, raiders, raiders! When the fisherfolk saw the fires burning on the high places, they would put their nets and ploughs aside and take up their swords and axes. Their lords would rush from their castles, attended by their knights and men-at-arms. War horns would echo across the waters from Green Shield and Grey Shield, Oaken Shield and South Shield, and their longships would come sliding out from moss-covered stone pens along the shores, oars flashing as they swarmed across the straits to seal the Mander and hound and harry the raiders upriver to their doom. Euron had sent Torwald Browntooth and the Red Oarsmen up the Mander with a dozen swift longships, so the lords of the Shield Islands would spill forth in pursuit. By the time his main fleet arrived, only a handful of fighting men remained to defend the isles themselves. The Ironborn had come in on the evening tide, so the glare of the setting sun would keep them hidden from the Greybeards in the watchtowers until it was too late. The wind was at their backs, as it had been all the way down from Old Wick. It was whispered about the fleet that Euron's wizards had much and more to do with that, that the crow's eye appeased the storm god with blood sacrifice. How else would he have dared sail so far to the west, instead of following the shoreline, as was the custom? The Ironborn ran their longships up onto the stony shingles and spilled out into the purple dusk with steel glimmering in their hands. By then the fires were burning in the high places, but few remained to take up arms. Greyshield, Greenshield, and Southshield fell before the sun came up. Oakenshield lasted half a day longer, and when the men of the Four Shields broke off their pursuit of Torwald and the Red Oarsmen and turned down river, they found the Iron Fleet waiting at the Mander's mouth. All fell out as Euron said it would, Victarion told the dusky woman as she bound up his hand with linen. His wizards must have seen it. He had three aboard the Silence, Kellan Humble had confided in a whisper. Queer men and terrible they were, but the crow's eye had made them slaves. He still needs me to fight his battles, though, Victarion insisted. Wizards may be well and good, but blood and steel win wars. The vinegar made his wound hurt worse than ever. He shoved the woman away and closed his fist, glowering. Bring me wine. He drank in the darkness, brooding on his brother. If I do not strike the blow with mine own hand, am I still a kinslayer? Victarion feared no man, but the drowned god's curse gave him pause. If another strikes him down at my command, will his blood still stain my hands? Aeron Dampair would know the answer, but the priest was somewhere back on the Iron Islands, still hoping to raise the Ironborn against their new crowned king. Newt's the barber can shave a man with a thrown axe from 20 yards away, and none of Euron's mongrels could stand against Wolf One-Ear or Andric the Unsmiling. Any of them could do it. But what a man can do and what a man will do are two different things, he knew. Euron's blasphemies will bring down the drowned god's wrath upon us all, Aeron had prophesied back on Old Wick. We must stop him, brother. We are still of Balon's blood, are we not? So is he, Victarion had said. I like it no more than you, but Euron is the king. Your Kingsmoot raised him up, and you put the driftwood crown upon his head yourself. I placed the crown upon his head, said the priest, seaweed dripping in his hair, and gladly will I wrest it off again and crown you in his stead. Only you are strong enough to fight him. The drowned god raised him up, Victarion complained. Let the drowned god cast him down. Aeron gave him a baleful look, the look that had been known to sour wells and make women barren. It was not the god who spoke. Euron is known to keep wizards and foul sorcerers on that red ship of his. They sent some spell among us, so we could not hear the sea. The captains and the kings were drunk with all this talk of dragons. Drunk and fearful of that horn. You heard the sound it made. It makes no matter. Euron is our king. Not mine, the priest declared. The drowned god helps bold men, not those who cower below their decks when the storm is rising. If you will not bestir yourself to remove the crow's eye from the seastone chair, I must take the task upon myself. How? You have no ships, no swords. I have my voice, the priest replied, and the god is with me. Mine is the strength of the sea, a strength the crow's eye cannot hope to withstand. The waves may break upon the mountain, yet still they come, wave upon wave, and in the end only pebbles remain where once the mountain stood, and soon even the pebbles are swept away to be ground beneath the sea for all eternity. Pebbles? Victarion grumbled. You are mad if you think to bring the crow's eye down with talk of waves and pebbles. The Ironborn shall be waves, the Dampair said. Not the great and lordly, but the simple folk, tillers of the soil and fishers of the sea. The captains and the kings raised Euron up, but the common folk shall tear him down. I shall go to Great Wick, to Harlaw, to Orkmont, to Pike itself. In every town and village shall my words be heard. No godless man may sit the sea stone chair. He shook his shaggy head and stalked back out into the night. When the sun came up the next day, Aeron Greyjoy had vanished from Old Wick. Even his drowned men knew not where. They said the Crow's Eye only laughed when he was told. But though the priest was gone, his dire warnings lingered. Victorian found himself remembering Baelor Blacktide's words as well. Baelon was mad, Aeron is madder, and Euron is maddest of them all. The young lord had tried to sail home after the King's Moot, refusing to accept Euron as his liege. But the Iron Fleet had closed the bay. The habit of obedience was rooted deep in Victorian Greyjoy, and Euron wore the driftwood crown. Nightflyer was seized, Lord Blacktide delivered to the king in chains. Euron's mutes and mongrels had cut him into 7 parts to feed the 7 green land gods he worshipped. As a reward for his loyal service, the new crowned king had given Victorian the Dusky Woman, taken off some slaver bound for Lys. "I want none of your leavings," he had told his brother scornfully. But when the Crow's Eye said that the woman would be killed unless he took her, he had weakened. Her tongue had been torn out, but elsewise she was undamaged and beautiful besides, with skin as brown as oiled teak. Yet sometimes, when he looked at her, he found himself remembering the first woman his brother had given him to make a man of him. Victorian wanted to use the Dusky Woman once again, but found himself unable. "Fetch me another skin of wine," he told her, "then get out." When she returned with a skin of sour red, the captain took it up on deck, where he could breathe the clean sea air. He drank half the skin and poured the rest into the sea for all the men who died. The Iron Victory lingered for hours off the mouth of the Mander. As the greater part of the Iron Fleet got underway for Oakenshield, Victorian kept Grief, Lord Dragon, Ironwind, and Maiden's Bane about him as a rear guard. They pulled survivors from the sea and watched Hardhand sink slowly, dragged under by the wreck that she had rammed. By the time she vanished beneath the waters, Victorian had the count he'd asked for. He had lost 6 ships and captured 38. "It will serve," he told Newt. "To the oars. We return to Lord Hewitt's town." His oarsmen bent their backs toward Oakenshield, and the Iron Captain went below decks once again. "I could kill him," he told the Dusky Woman, "though it is a great sin to kill your king and a worse one to kill your brother." He frowned. "Asha should have given me her voice. How could she have ever hoped to win the captains and the kings, her with her pine cones and her turnips? Balon's blood is in her, but she is still a woman. She had run after the king's moot. The night the driftwood crown was placed on Euron's head, she and her crew had melted away. Some small part of Victorian was glad she had. If the girl keeps her wits about her, she will wed some northern lord and live with him in his castle, far from the sea and Euron Crow's Eye. "Lord Hewitt's town, Lord Captain," a crewman called. Victorian rose. The wine had dulled the throbbing in his hand. Perhaps he would have Hewitt's maester look at it if the man had not been killed. He returned to deck as they came around a headland. The way Lord Hewitt's castle sat above the harbour reminded him of Lordsport, though this town was twice as big. A score of longships prowled the waters beyond the port, the golden kraken writhing on their sails. Hundreds more were beached along the shingles and drawn up to the piers that lined the harbour. At a stone quay stood 3 great cogs and a dozen smaller ones, taking on plunder and provisions. Victorian gave orders for the Iron Victory to drop anchor. "Have a boat made ready." The town seemed strangely still as they approached. Most of the shops and houses had been looted, as their smashed doors and broken shutters testified. But only the sept had been put to the torch. The streets were strewn with corpses, each with a small flock of carrion crows in attendance. A gang of sullen survivors moved amongst them, chasing off the black birds and tossing the dead into the back of a wagon for burial. The notion filled Victorian with disgust. No true son of the sea would want to rot beneath the ground. How would he ever find the drowned god's watery halls to drink and feast for all eternity? The silence was amongst the ships they passed. Victorian's gaze was drawn to the iron figurehead at her prow, the mouthless maiden with the wind-blown hair and outstretched arm. Her mother-of-pearl eyes seemed to follow him. She had a mouth like any other woman till the crow's eyes sewed it shut. As they neared the shore, he noticed a line of women and children herded up onto the deck of one of the great cogs. Some had their hands bound behind their backs, and all wore loops of hempen rope about their necks. "Who are they?" he asked the men who helped tie up their boat. "Widows and orphans. They're to be sold as slaves." Sold? There were no slaves in the Iron Islands, only thralls. A thrall was bound to service, but he was not chattel. His children were born free, so long as they were given to the drowned god. And thralls were never bought nor sold for gold. A man paid the iron price for thralls, or else had none. "They should be thralls, or salt wives," Victorian complained. "It's by the king's decree," the man said. "The strong have always taken from the weak," said Newt the barber. "Thralls or slaves, it makes no matter. Their men could not defend them, so no, they are ours, to do with as we will." "It is not the old way," he might have said, but there was no time. His victory had preceded him, and men were gathering round to offer congratulations. Victorian let them fawn, until one began to praise Euron's daring. "It is daring to sail out of sight of land, so no word of our coming could reach these islands before us," he growled. "But crossing half the world to hunt for dragons? That is something else." He did not wait for a reply, but shouldered through the press and on up to the keep. Lord Hewitt's castle was small but strong, with thick walls and studded oaken gates that evoked his house's ancient arms, an oak escutcheon studded with iron upon a field of blue and white. But it was the kraken of House Greyjoy that flew atop his green-roofed towers now, and they found the great gates burned and broken. On the ramparts walked Ironborn with spears and axes, and some of Euron's mongrels too. In the yard, Victorian came on Gorald Goodbrother and Old Drum, speaking quietly with Roderick Harlaw. Newt the barber gave a hoot at the sight of them. "Reader!" he called out. "Why is your face so long? Your misgivings were for naught. The day is ours, and ours the prize." Lord Roderick's mouth puckered. "Those rocks, you mean? All four together wouldn't make Harlaw. We have won some stones and trees and trinkets, and the enmity of House Tyrell." "The roses?" Newt laughed. "What rose can harm the krakens of the deep? We have taken their shields from them and smashed them all to pieces. Who will protect them now?" "Highgarden," replied the reader. "Soon enough all the power of the Reach will be marshalled against us, Barber. And then you may learn that some roses have steel thorns." Drum nodded, one hand on the hilt of his red rein. "Lord Tale bears the great sword Heartsbane, forged of Valyrian steel, and he is always in Lord Tyrell's van." Victorian's hunger flared. "Let him come. I will take his sword for mine own, as your own forebear took red rein. Let them all come, and bring the Lannisters as well. A lion may be fierce enough on land, but at sea the kraken rules supreme. He would give half his teeth for the chance to try his axe against the Kingslayer or the Knight of Flowers. That was the sort of battle that he understood. The Kingslayer was accursed in the eyes of gods and men, but the warrior was honored and revered." "Have no fear, Lord Captain," said the reader. "They will come. His grace desires it. Why else would he have commanded us to let Hewitt's ravens fly?" "You read too much and fight too little," Newt said. "Your blood is milk." But the reader made as if he had not heard. A riotous feast was in progress when Victorian entered the hall. Ironborn filled the tables, drinking and shouting and jostling each other, boasting of the men they had slain, the deeds they had done, the prizes they had won. Many were bedecked with plunder. Left-hand Lucas Cod and Quellan Humble had torn tapestries off the walls to serve as cloaks. Germund Botley wore a rope of pearls and garnets over his gilded Lannister breastplate. Andric the Unsmiling staggered by with a woman under each arm. Though he remained unsmiling, he had rings on every finger. Instead of trenchers carved from old stale bread, the captains were eating off solid silver platters. Newt the barber's face grew dark with anger as he looked about. The crow's eye sends us forth to face the longships, whilst his own men take the castles and the villages and grab all the loot and women. What has he left for us? We have the glory. Glory is good, said Newt, but gold is better. Victorian shrugged. The crow's eye says we shall have all of Westeros, the arbor, Old Town, Highgarden. That's where you'll find your gold. But enough talk. I'm hungry. By right of blood, Victorian might have claimed a seat on the dais, but he did not care to eat with Euron and his creatures. Instead, he chose a place by Ralph the Limper, the captain of the Lord Quellan. A great victory, Lord Captain, said the Limper. A victory worthy of a lordship. You should have an island. Lord Victorian? Aye, and why not? It might not be the sea stone chair, but it would be something. Hotho Harlaw was across the table, sucking meat off a bone. He flicked it aside and hunched forward. The knights to have Greyshield, my cousin, did you hear? No. Victorian looked across the hall to where Sir Harris Harlaw sat drinking wine from a golden cup, a tall man, long-faced and austere. Why would Euron give that one an island? Hotho held out his empty wine cup, and a pale young woman in a gown of blue velvet and gilt lace refilled it for him. The knight took Grimston by himself. He planted his standard beneath the castle and defied the Grims to face him. One did, and then another and another. He slew them all. Well, near enough, two yielded. When the seventh man went down, Lord Grim's Septon decided the gods had spoken and surrendered the castle. Hotho laughed. He'll be the Lord of Greyshield and welcome to it. With him gone, I am the Reader's heir. He thumped his wine cup against his chest. Hotho the Humpback, Lord of Harlaw. Seven, you say? Victorian wondered how Nightfall would fare against his axe. He had never fought a man armed with a Valyrian steel blade, though he had thrashed young Harris Harlaw many a time when both of them were young. As a boy, Harlaw had been fast friends with Balon's eldest son, Roderick, who had died beneath the walls of Seagard. The feast was good, the wine was of the best, and there was roast ox, rare and bloody, and stuffed ducks as well, and buckets of fresh crabs. The serving wenches wore fine woolens and plush velvets. The Lord Captain did not fail to note. He took them for scullions dressed up in the clothes of Lady Hewitt and her ladies, until Hotho told him they were Lady Hewitt and her ladies. It amused the crow's eye to make them wait and pour. There were eight of them, her ladyship herself, still handsome, though grown somewhat stout, and seven younger women aged from 25 to 10, her daughters and good daughters. Lord Hewitt himself sat in his accustomed place upon the dais, dressed in all his heraldic finery. His arms and legs had been tied to his chair, and a huge white radish shoved between his teeth so he could not speak, though he could see and hear. The crow's eye had claimed the place of honour at his lordship's right hand. A pretty buxom girl of 17 or 18 years was in his lap, barefoot and dishevelled, her arms around his neck. "Who is that?" Victorian asked the men around him. "His lordship's bastard daughter," laughed Hotho. "Before Euron took the castle, she was made to wait at table on the rest and take her own meals with the servants." Euron put his blue lips to her throat, and the girl giggled and whispered something in his ear. Smiling, he kissed her throat again. Her white skin was covered with red marks where his mouth had been. They made a rosy necklace about her neck and shoulders. Another whisper in his ear, and this time the crow's eye laughed aloud, then slammed his wine cup down for silence. "Good ladies," he called out to his high-born serving women, "Thalia is concerned for your fine gowns. She would not have them stained with grease and wine and dirty groping fingers, since I have promised that she may choose her own clothes from your wardrobes after the feast. So you had best disrobe." A roar of laughter washed over the great hall, and Lord Hewitt's face turned so red that Victorian thought his head might burst. The women had no choice but to obey. The youngest one cried a little, but her mother comforted her and helped undo the laces down her back. Afterward, they continued to serve as before, moving along the tables with flagons full of wine to fill each empty cup, only now they did so naked. He shames Hewitt as he once shamed me, the captain thought, remembering how his wife had sobbed as he was beating her. The men of the Four Shields oft married one another, he knew, just as the Ironborn did. One of these naked serving wenches might well be Sir Talbot Seri's wife. It was one thing to kill a foe, another to dishonor him. Victorian made a fist. His hand was bloody where his wound had soaked through the linen. On the dais, Euron pushed aside his slattern and climbed upon the table. The captains began to bang their cups and stamp their feet upon the floor.
"Euron!" they shouted. "Euron! Euron! Euron!"
It was Kingsmoot. "Come again." "I swore to give you Westeros," the crow's eye said, when the tumult died away. "And here is your first taste. A morsel, nothing more. But we shall feast before the fall of night." The torches along the walls were burning bright, and so was he, blue lips, blue eye, and all. What the kraken grasps, it does not loose. These isles were once ours, and now they are again. But we need strong men to hold them. So, rise, Sir Harris Harlaw, Lord of Greyshield. The knight stood, one hand upon Nightfall's moonstone pommel. Rise, Andric the Unsmiling, Lord of Southshield. Andric shoved away his women and lurched to his feet like a mountain rising sudden from the sea. Rise, Maron Volmark, Lord of Greenshield. A beardless boy of 6 and 10 years, Volmark stood hesitantly, looking like the Lord of Rabbits. And rise, Newt the Barber, Lord of Oakenshield. Newt's eyes grew wary as if he feared he was the butt of some cruel jape. "A lord," he croaked. Victorian had expected the crow's eye to give the lordships to his own creatures, Stonehand and the Red Oarsman and left-hand Lucas Cod. A king must needs be open-handed, he tried to tell himself. But another voice whispered, "Euron's gifts are poisoned." When he turned it over in his head, he saw it plain. The knight was the reader's chosen heir, and Andric the Unsmiling the strong right arm of Dunstan Drum. Volmark is a callow boy, but he has Black Harren's blood in him through his mother. And the barber. Victorian grabbed him by the forearm. "Refuse him." Newt looked at him as if he had gone mad. "Refuse him? Lands and lordship? Will you make me a lord?" He wrenched his arm away and stood basking in the cheers. "And now he steals my men away," Victorian thought. King Euron called to Lady Hewitt for a fresh cup of wine and raised it high above his head. "Captains and kings, lift your cups to the lords of the Four Shields." Victorian drank with the rest. There is no wine so sweet as wine taken from a foe. Someone had told him that once, his father or his brother Balon. "One day I shall drink your wine, Crow's Eye, and take from you all that you hold dear." But was there anything Euron held dear? "On the morrow, we prepare once more to sail," the king was saying. "Fill our casks anew with spring water, take every sack of grain and cask of beef, and as many sheep and goats as we can carry. The wounded who are still hale enough to pull an oar will row. The rest shall remain here to help hold these isles for their new lords. Torwald and the Red Oarsmen will soon be back with more provisions. Our decks will stink of pigs and chickens on the voyage east, but we'll return with dragons." "When?" The voice was Lord Roderick's. "When shall we return, Your Grace? A year? 3 years? 5? Your dragons are a world away, and autumn is upon us." The reader walked forward, sounding all the hazards. "Galleys guard the Redwine Straits. The Dornish coast is dry and bleak, 400 leagues of whirlpools, cliffs and hidden shoals with hardly a safe landing anywhere. Beyond wait the stepstones with their storms and their nests of lysine and meerish pirates. If 1,000 ships set sail, 300 may reach the far side of the narrow sea. And then what? Lice will not welcome us, nor will Volantis. Where will you find fresh water, food? The first storm will scatter us across half the earth. A smile played across Euron's blue lips. I am the storm, my lord. The first storm and the last. I have taken the silence on longer voyages than this, and ones far more hazardous. Have you forgotten? I have sailed the Smoking Sea and seen Valyria. Every man there knew that the doom still ruled Valyria. The very sea there boiled and smoked, and the land was overrun with demons. It was said that any sailor who so much as glimpsed the fiery mountains of Valyria rising above the waves would soon die a dreadful death. Yet the Crow's Eye had been there and returned. Have you? The reader asked so softly. Euron's blue smile vanished. Reader, he said into the quiet, you would do well to keep your nose in your books. Victorian could feel the unease in the hall. He pushed himself to his feet. Brother, he boomed, you have not answered Harlaw's questions. Euron shrugged. The price of slaves is rising. We will sell our slaves in Lys and Volantis. That, and the plunder we have taken here, will give us sufficient gold to buy provisions. Are we slavers now? Asked the reader. And for what? Dragons that no man here has seen? Shall we chase some drunken sailor's fancy to the far ends of the earth? His words drew mutters of assent.
Slaver's Bay is too far, called out Ralph the Limper.
And too close to Valyria, shouted Quellan Humble. Freyleg the Strong said,
High Garden's close. I say look for dragons there, the golden kind.
Alvin Sharp said,
Why sail the world when the Mandar lies before us?
Red Ralph Stonehouse bounded to his feet.
Old Town is richer, and the Arbor richer still. Redwine's fleet is off, away! We need only reach out our hand to pluck the ripest fruit in Westeros.
Fruit?
The king's eye looked more black than blue. Only a craven would steal a fruit when he could take the orchard.
It is the Arbor we want, said Red Ralph,
and other men took up the cry. The crow's eye let the shouts wash over him. Then he leapt down from the table, grabbed his slattern by the arm, and pulled her from the hall. Fled like a dog. Euron's hold upon the sea stone chair suddenly did not seem as secure as it had a few moments before. They will not follow him to Slaver's Bay. Perhaps they are not such dogs and fools as I had feared. That was such a merry thought that Victorian had to wash it down. He drained a cup with the barber to show him that he did not begrudge him his lordship, even if it came from Euron's hand. Outside, the sun went down. Darkness gathered beyond the walls, but inside the torches burned with a ruddy orange glow, and their smoke gathered under the rafters like a grey cloud. Drunken men began to dance the finger dance. At some point, left-hand Lucas Cod decided he wanted one of Lord Hewitt's daughters, so he took her on a table whilst her sister screamed and sobbed. Victorian felt a tap upon his shoulder. One of Euron's mongrel sons stood behind him, a boy of 10 with woolly hair and skin the color of mud.
My father wishes words with you.
Victorian rose unsteadily. He was a big man with a large capacity for wine, but even so he had drunk too much.
I beat her to death with mine own hands, he thought, but the crow's eye killed her when he shoved himself inside her. I had no choice.
He followed the bastard boy from the hall and up a winding stone stair. The sounds of rape and revelry diminished as they climbed, until there was only the soft scrape of boots on stone. The crow's eye had taken Lord Hewitt's bedchamber along with his bastard daughter. When he entered, the girl was sprawled naked on the bed, snoring softly. Euron stood by the window, drinking from a silver cup. He wore the sable cloak he took from Blacktide, his red leather eye patch, and nothing else. "When I was a boy, I dreamt that I could fly," he announced. "When I woke, I couldn't, or so the maester said.